Hey folks, thanks for being on the Vamp Podcast. This is Mike Lafferty, your host. I have Jason Tondreau and Aid Smith as my co-host. Hey Jason, hey Aid.
Hello.
Hey guys.
Legendary comics writer Dan Abnetz has joined us. Dan, thanks for your time.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Just understand you're working on Hercules right now for Marvel.
And yes.
Of course, I mean, in the recent past, you've done such famous work as, you know, reinventing Guardians of the Galaxy, which then went on to become incredibly popular. You're recently doing, the old school Battlestar Galactica.
Yes. Indeed, yes, that as well, yeah.
And now we're working on Hercules. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing with that?
Yeah, my intention was to try and write Hercules not deliberately differently to the way he's been portrayed before in the Marvel Universe, but just to see if there was a new way of handling him as a character. And I've been aware of Hercules for years as a Marvel character, but there are many iterations of Hercules beyond the Marvel Universe, mythologically and in other media forms. And I was writing Guardians 3000 for the Secret Wars, which became the Korvac Saga, which obviously revisited the Korvac Saga from years ago, the Avengers story which the Guardians featured in. And Hercules was a member of the Avengers lineup at that time, so I found myself by default writing Hercules. And in doing so, it suddenly occurred to me that there might be other ways of handling him. He's always, generally speaking, his books have been very sort of lighthearted and fun and sort of larger than life, pretty much like Hercules. Bob Layton, wonderful handling of the character, and Greg Pak more recently. But there is always a sense of, and I think this is the criticism, there's always a sense of sort of buffoonery with Hercules, that he's a hero who's immensely powerful but makes a lot of mistakes. And he lives a very kind of rowdy life, and he's a bit of a handful. It just occurred to me that there might be an interesting way of portraying him as akin to more like his mythological origins as being this great hero. By rights, Hercules should be the most famous hero because he's sort of the first superhero ever. And he must have been very good at what he did for a very long time for him to have established that kind of reputation. So I imagined this scenario whereby Hercules was this extraordinary hero. He kind of was capable of doing anything, not just in terms of physical prowess, but in sheer terms of courage and tenacity. He was capable of doing things that exceeded almost any other hero you can think of. But because he's immortal, he's lived for a long time. So he might spend 100 years doing something incredible at great personal cost, and then he might take 20 years off, and to him that's a weekend. You know, he will just go out, he'll hit the town, he'll go dancing, he'll get very drunk, he'll do all, you know, he'll misbehave, and that's his way of blowing off steam after being a hero significantly for a long time. And I thought to myself, maybe the slightly more cartoonish celebrity superhero we've seen in the Marvel Universe since he appeared, I think 1965 or whatever it was, he first appeared as a character there. Maybe this is him on downtime. Yes, he gets involved. Yes, he has adventures, and yes, he does some extraordinary things. But generally speaking, this is him going, oh, the modern world's a great place. I can relax and have fun, and I'm famous, and people love me, and I can get invited to all the best parties and all this stuff. So I really thought about maybe this is the point in this book, is the point at which he goes, do you know what? People think I'm a joke. They think I'm a disruptive influence. They think that if I turn up, the joint's going to get wrecked. As a result, I'm sort of a throwback, that people talk about Hercules, but they don't really understand what Hercules means in terms of being a hero. Maybe it's time I got back to work, took things seriously, cleaned myself up, straightened my act out, and actually started to be a hero again in the way I used to be. So this, hence this new series, where he is quite resolved, he's quite serious. It's not a book without humour, but this is him living a straight life in a clean and sober life, more particularly. He's deliberately given up drinking so that he doesn't disgrace himself. He is trying to lead this existence and be a hero available for people who need a hero in New York. So I've tried to, although there are strong mythological elements, I've tried to make it sort of seem as real as possible, set it in a real place, make it contemporary, surround him with people in the community, and see what happens with that. And so far, it's very rewarding to write that, and it's been enormously good fun. reading the responses. People seem to like that. It's like I said, I'm not doing it because I think there was something wrong with the character before or the way the character was handled before, and I'm sure the character will end up being that character again in other incarnations. But right now I thought, is there a different way of making us think about Hercules differently and go, wait a minute, he's pretty cool. He is a pretty cool character, and he's not that sort of Olympian joke who turns up and raises a glass of meat and then breaks the table and all that kind of stuff. So that really was the philosophy behind trying to do what I'm trying to do.
I remember the first time I read, I met Hercules in comics at all, was his first fight with Thor.
Yes.
Which I think it was a Thor annual.
Yes.
And it's about a 30-page sequence with almost no dialogue, where they just kick the crap out of each other.
Yes.
In a colossal, in a bigger and bigger fashion. And there was nothing comical about that story. That story was as epic and mythological and serious as you could have wanted it to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and there have been many occasions actually in his long Marvel career where he has been an extraordinary hero, and I'm not taking that away from him. I just think the general tone is that people expect sort of a comedy book. They expect something that is full of archaic Greek language and these and thous and this, that, and the other, and the Hercules will be a bit of a kind of man out of time and anachronism who sort of gets stuff wrong and says silly things and has an old-fashioned way of looking at stuff. And I think, and I was actually thinking about it in terms of Thor, because Thor is all those things. Thor is this, it was, again, demigod, well, actually actual god, but, you know, divine being from another pantheon. He has this sort of connection to an ancient and semi-mythological world, yet in the Marvel Universe, people take him completely seriously. There is no doubt that when Thor turns up, it's not like, it's Thor. He is one of the primary Avengers. He's an absolutely, colossal hero who deserves respect and everything like that. And I was thinking, Hercules should be that too. Hercules ends up coming off as being the joke version of Thor.
Yeah,
he's the less serious version of Thor. And I thought it would be quite nice. And as I say, what I tried to show in this book is that he is a man capable of humor. There is a lot of natural humor, but it's natural humor. It's not forced buffoonish humor. And there's, I hope, a certain degree of pathos in there as well.
Yeah.
I was reading the preview of a recent issue where he has Gilgamesh as kind of a down on his luck roommate.
Yes. that was one of those kind of real world touches. I thought it wouldn't be quite fun if he had a guy, an old friend who was crashing at his place because he had nowhere else to go. And then the idea that it was Gilgamesh, I just thought that was quite good. The Gilgamesh, of course, if you go down the Marvel pecking order of heroic demigods, you've got Thor, then Hercules, then Gilgamesh. And I just thought, I like the idea that Gilgamesh sort of represents in a almost a sweet way is what, if Hercules didn't have the big personality, what Hercules would be now. He would be kind of, he's not sure, he's lacking confidence, he doesn't know whether he fits into the world. He thinks about being a hero, but then he has another bowl of cereal and watches another quiz show and all this kind of stuff. And I quite like that. I quite like the idea of Hercules going, not only Hercules trying to get his own life back together again and show people what a serious immortal hero is like when he gets down to business on a regular basis, but also trying to bring Gilgamesh along with him, trying to encourage him and saying, it's not that hard. This is what we were born to do. You can do this too. And just encourage him back into the fray, which I think we're going to see happening over the next few issues with hilarious consequences. So, he was a nice sort of, foil, I guess, for Hercules in that very real New York setting.
I don't want to crowd Aid out here. Aid, did you have something? I have more questions, but I don't want to monopolize all of Dan's stuff.
The first thing that I come to mind when I knew we were going to talk to Dan was, are we going to see him interact with Amadeus Cho, the new Hulk?
I think it would be a massive, massive, massive failure on my part and Marvel's part if at some point those two characters who were bonded together clearly very much in Greg's run on the character, if they didn't, that would be an oversight, let's face it. So I am not a person who's going to make oversights. And that's as far as I'm going to go. that's a kind of unofficial yes. I want to see Hercules interact with the Marvel Universe and with characters that have known him for a long time. I mean, there will be people on that list, including, I guess, any of the Avengers, any of the Avengers that were also champions. Black Widow's got to be on that list. Other people who've got long associations with Hercules, it will be great to see him interact with, and particularly to get their take on him now. He is slightly different. You know, it wouldn't be a kind of what the hell's happened to you. It would be kind of, oh, this is, you know, you're taking steps in your life to change your life. That's interesting. So there'll be interesting reactions there. And the top of that list has got to be Amadeus, particularly because, you know, some fairly big things have changed in his life as well. And on a daily basis, they change. That's a Hulk joke there. So I think the idea of putting them together would be a very good one. But there is Hercules as a book is sort of very, very much the real end of the Marvel Universe. It's the authentically realistic day to day, everyday end of the Marvel Universe, into which I want to put the Marvel Universe superhero characters so that Hercules can interact with them, and also on the other side, the mythological elements. The mythological elements will turn up, but they won't be camp mythological elements. They will be surprisingly, I was going to say realistic, but you know what I mean. They're trying to handle the sort of things that he will encounter that are throwbacks to his own heritage that will pop up in ways that you go, oh God, that's what a giant's really like, or that's what a dragon is really like, or whatever. So there is a sense of it being, of there being some sort of reality fixing this, because the take on the character won't work unless it's reality, which incidentally is why we've got Luke Ross on the art. He's fabulous. And one of the things Luke does particularly well, and why he was chosen for the task, is that he does the spectacular and the huge and the explosive stuff you want a book with Hercules in it to be, but he also does the real world, I think, very, very well. There is a sense of solidity and reality in terms of the as it were, the sets, the locations, the costumes, the real people around it. He does that really, really, really well. There's a shot in the first issue of Full Page Flash, actually, of Hercules walking down the street with the two young kids he helps out in the first issue. And there's a real sense of location in that. And, you know, it's not generic New York. I think it works really, really well. So that Luke is also helping very much to kind of ground this book as well.
Dan, I've read a lot of Joseph Campbell. I'm sure you're familiar with the Campbell sort of idea that all heroes are basically the same story.
Yes.
And I was wondering what you thought of that and how it applies to Hercules. In other words, is there something about Hercules' story that is unique to Hercules' story?
Well,
distinguishes him from other mythological characters.
I think there is to a certain extent, but I think I go a step further. I mean, Campbell's work is extremely important, and I think if nothing else, it's been used by so many great myth makers as a template to show how things work. I think he's extremely valuable, and I think it's basically correct. I also think it's completely wrong. I think it's completely wrong. Exactly like, you know, sort of when you boil down a kind of creative writing class to the idea that there are only seven stories.
Maybe you may be
able to make a case for that. The hero's journey might be something that you can make a case for quite authentically as a basic instructional thing to make you think about things in a broader sense. However, they're far too restrictive. I think that there is a potential danger, for instance, in movie makers, for instance, looking at Campbell going, hero's journey, got that, ticked all the boxes, so it must be a good story. Nonsense. Yeah. Nonsense. It is the most simple distillation of the way mythological stories or any kind of great story works. So pinch of salt there, but absolutely, I think, you know, Campbell is a useful thing. And when Campbell is writing about heroes, He goes back to the earliest heroes that we identify by name. You know, Beowulf, for instance. Gilgamesh is another one. I mean, he's talking about those sort of proto-heroes on which the rest of the heroic canon is based. And Hercules is definitely in that. The problem with Hercules, or the interesting thing with Hercules, is mythologically speaking, forget the Marvel version, mythologically speaking, there are so many stories about Hercules. The mythological stories of Hercules are vast. There are the obvious epic adventures like the labors and that kind of stuff, but they're often very contradictory. Hercules betrays lots of almost schizophrenic characteristics. Sometimes he's a very good guy, sometimes he's a very bad guy. He does all sorts of different things like that. And there's also a whole part of his canon of stories which are comedies, which are Hercules the buffoon being silly, which is, and this is classically speaking. So it seems to me, and it's been supported by a lot of things I've been looking at, is that Hercules himself, the mythological Hercules himself, is probably just assembled from, like the Odyssey and the Iliad and the other great works. The myths of Hercules collectively are assembled from all sorts of folkloric myths that have grown up possibly before we could write them down, from oral histories, from different cultures, about heroes doing things. And ultimately, they've gone, oh, this thing, we'll say it was Hercules did that, because they can't remember who did it, actually did it. So it becomes another one of Hercules' myths. So Hercules' own canon of stories is reflective of a lot of stories about a lot of people doing things in sort of prehistory that have become Hercules as that kind of first hero figure. And I think that's a cool idea. I like the idea that, that Hercules is the kind of, icon, that represents all the heroes that happened before recorded history. And in Marvel terms, I like the idea that Hercules has lived many lives, that long before, I mean, he was Heracles before he was Hercules. Before that, in the first issue, I invent some sort of prehistoric names for him, who he was. The idea that he's lived down the ages, not deliberately taking over different guises, but, you know, he's lived in, I don't know, hypothetically, he lived in Africa for a while. The people he was with there called him something else. So he's known by that name, and he was known by that name for 150 years, and then he became somebody else. So the idea that he is, what is eternal about him is his heroism and his courage and his willingness to labor for people. So I tried to sort of reflect what is known historically and in terms of literature about Hercules mythologically in the Marvel character to give him that kind of grand legacy. And if he is anything at all, he is the basis of the template. He's basis of the Campbell template. And I think, and I haven't done it yet in the comic, but at some point I'd almost like to see Herc sitting there in his apartment reading the Hero with a Thousand Faces and going, God, this is how did he know that star? And then also to go, but it wasn't that simple. You can't tick all the boxes. You can't, just because I did this and this and this doesn't mean I was successful. It's not a diagram. It's being out there in the world doing things. So I think it's touching on that and thinking about those sorts of things. And also working out how much of that you can, as it were, shift sideways to make it fit Marvel's Hercules. Because let's face it, what we're dealing with here is Marvel's Hercules, not all the Herculeses. There should be a plural for Herculeses. Herculi? There should be, anyway, it is very much that particular character, that particular iteration of Hercules that we're dealing with.
Okay, I'm going to let Jason do all the smart questions. So I'll ask all the geeky questions instead, okay? Because you now have Earth Prime rather than the 616, has that gave you an extra bit of a leeway to kind of reinterpret Hercules and kind of say, hey, this is the new version of Hercules, rather than kind of, that's what Marvel basically said, hey, go for it, do what you want, because it's a new world, you can do what you need to.
Tom Breville never actually used those words. But in many respects, yes. I mean, it was fun because as I say, I was writing Korvac Saga. I can almost feel in my bones a different way of doing a Hercules book just to see if it works differently. I mentioned it to my editor. She immediately said, submit that idea. That's great. And I think Marvel was looking for people, actually actively looking for people to come up with the kind of, as it were, new takes on classic Marvel heroes to see if we could use the opportunity to do things. And I'd sort of done it accidentally, inadvertently, and they jumped on it and they said, yes, do that. So I think Earth Prime, and the launch of Hercules out of Secret Wars is simply a very nice situation to be in, because it means that if any long-term reader or continuity buff is looking at it going, wait a minute, how does that fit? It doesn't. And any contradiction or indeed mistake on my part can be overlooked because it is now Earth Prime and we can do that. And we can make slightly more bigger, bolder statements about his history and where he comes from and who he's been without it being a horrible, horrible reboot that annoys people hugely. Yes. Is the simple answer, but it was more a case of me saying I've got an idea and Marvel going, yeah, we've got a great home for it, rather than them saying, take Hercules and see if you can, you know, sort of customize him and make him a new Earth Prime version of Hercules. It was the other way around.
Well, so I had my turn for the geeky question.
Hello. I've got things like smart now. That's not good.
Now I would be remiss if I did not ask you about the Korvac Saga, because
Korvac is one of my favorite, goofiest Marvel antagonists.
Yeah.
I want to ask your thoughts and opinions on the original Korvac saga, since you obviously had to read it and get into it when you were writing your your take on it. What do you think of the original Korvac saga?
I think it's great, actually. It is, I guess, not held up as one of the absolute all-time classic Avengers or anything else stories.
Yeah.
And there's a number of different reasons for that, and some of them are very prosaic reasons, but I read it at the time and was very impressed by it at the time. And it was actually my suggestion that was the thing that we based the Guardians 3000 story on. It wasn't a handout from Marvel saying, okay, Guardians 3000 becomes Korvac, so go for it, Dan, go and read this story. They were saying, what, as it were, Marvel historical event would you like to focus on here? And I thought, Korvac saga. It was my first suggestion, and they immediately said, that's great. I think they weren't anticipating that, because it was a fairly unusual choice. Of course, it isn't an unusual choice, because it is one of the very few big events that the original Guardians of the Galaxy were involved in. So it kind of, the list of possibilities that I wouldn't otherwise have to shoehorn the original Guardians into was fairly limited. And I thought, well, here's this epic. It has been republished since. It made a profound effect on me when I was a kid. It's got the Avengers in it. It's a no-brainer. That's the one we do. That's the one we do. The fact that the Korvac saga was kind of the obvious thing to pick as a storyline to revisit for the purposes of Secret Wars, and it lent itself enormously well to that. And it was one of the few obvious things that included the original Guardians. But the reason Korvac saga is sort of not hailed as one of the all-time great stories, but it sort of is a number of very simple things. It was published, as it were, piecemeal. There were other Avengers stories going on. So there's not a block of sort of six or eight issues of the Korvac saga in the way that a story would be handled these days, because the books ran in different ways there. So sort of, if you get the collection of the Korvac saga, it's sort of, there's a couple of issues of it, then they do something else, and there's a couple of issues, and it's sort of much more organically threaded through the Avengers book at that point. Also, it's quite a shocking story. It really is a very shocking story. I remember that being the profound effect it had on me, is that it sort of ends with this literal decimation of the Avengers, that sort of they sort of all literally die trying to fight Korvac, and only survive because Korvac himself sort of has a change of heart. Korvac absolutely outclasses everybody and everything, and it was profoundly different to the way superhero stories, and indeed particularly Avengers stories, were supposed to work. It was dark, it was bleak, it was strange, it was unconventional. It certainly didn't tick all of Joseph Campbell's boxes. It was a very unusual story, and I think it was actually a very brave story to tell, and I think it should be regarded, looked back on and regarded as being sort of experimental, really, really interesting, and a quite dark and shocking story. And that's another one of the reasons that I wanted to use it, because it set up Korvac in the Secret Wars story in exactly that sense of being so supremely powerful, you can't even fight him. All you can try and do is find a way around that problem, which was a lovely parallel to the way Doom is portrayed in Secret Wars as well. So yes, I read it. Yes, I was aware of it. Yes, it was my choice, and absolutely, I kind of love it. I kind of love it for all its strangeness, and that was why I wanted to go and sort of revisit it.
Yeah, it's a great old story.
Yeah.
There was silence.
I think we were thinking about the callbacks over there.
Well, I had a question for you, but I feel like an asshole asking it, so I'm not sure if I should. But
Ask it. I can always refuse to answer.
We all know about you anyway, Mike. It's okay.
Everyone knows about me. This is true. All right. Well, here's the thing. Marvel hasn't always handled their mythological characters the best. I mean, Thor's been handled, let's just say better since the Ultimates and the movies. But let's look at Loki. I mean, he came off a really interesting turn in the Young Avengers. And then they do Agent of Asgard, which was an interesting book that didn't get a lot of support. They were doing some cool stories, but it seemed like Marvel wasn't really promoting it or really giving him much of a chance. And just kind of they let him run for 12 or 18 issues and just canceled them. Are you something you think about when you're writing Hercules and, trying to think of ways to, beat the curse, if you will? Or is that You're focusing
on well, I'm just trying to write a good book and hope that people want to read it. But that is really true of any comic this day and age. I don't think it's specifically about the mythological angles of Marvel or indeed any publisher. It is a much more cutthroat marketplace, and publishers are putting out a lot of material. And quite often, every day, I mean, Omega Men's a very good example over at DC, where it's a very good book that they actually managed to bring back because it sort of, on paper, it wasn't selling well enough, but people wanted to look at it again. And I think all you can do is do your best and try and tell stories. I think maybe that's although a lot of comics are falling by the wayside because they're not generating enough sales and they're cancelled, and yet they're really good books, and isn't it a shame? I think the flip side of that, the positive side of that, is it's making the creatives, writers and artists alike, be bolder about what they're doing with characters and saying, Joseph Campbell's getting an absolute beating in this conversation. That's really appalling. It's to say, let's not just conventionally go, okay, it's issue one, it's got to have a big fight, it's got to have this, that, and the other. We've got to follow the hero's journey. We've got to do all the conventional things. We've got to do it like a cliche. There is, I think, slightly more, good experimentation going on in even mainstream titles. In order to make them distinctive and interesting, and hope that they can put in that particular little spark that gives it a good readership. And you see the same thing happening in television. It's something that, for instance, Netflix and Amazon Prime and other content generators like that are doing, where they're going, well, we could do this comic, we could do this story as a TV show, but we can be slightly bolder about the way we do it, because things sink or swim, and it'd be better for it to swim and be different than just to play safe and do it that way. And that is not condemning the last 20 years of comics, but a comic, I don't think a comic's just got to be good anymore. A comic's got to be good and get noticed. And I think that means that people are trying to do some interesting things. I mean, yeah, another good example would be The Vision, that launched 2 or 3 months ago, where that's, I think even 10 years ago, that book would not have been approved, simply because it's such an unconventional take on a superhero solo title. It's a great book, and people have noticed it's a great book, which is fantastic. But it's not. It didn't fit the sort of the obvious remit of what a book should be doing. I think so. The slightly more precarious nature of the marketplace is encouraging invention and creativity, which can only be a good thing. And I don't think it is simply a case of the mythological characters struggling. I think it's a case of any good comic needs to really make its mark and show that it's doing something. If all good comics followed the same template, then why would you read all of them? You know, if you can read the same sorts of good stories in, I don't know, Daredevil, that you can in Cap and you can in Batman, then why read all of those comics? You want to go and read, for example, I'm not picking it for any other reason than just as an example, Daredevil. You want to read Daredevil because Daredevil's giving you something that only Daredevil can give you. Yeah. So forget convention, what's good about Daredevil? And the same is true of Hercules, the same is true of The Vision, the same is true of any title. Is the book's got to be good, it's got to follow the rules of what makes a good comic, but it's also got to be true to that character, so that if what happens in Hercules is your idea of a great comic, you can only find that in Hercules. Does that make any sense?
Yeah.
Or maybe I should just spend the next 10 minutes apologizing to Joseph Campbell.
I think what you're talking about is a distinctive voice of the character and also a vision for the creative team.
Yeah.
Right? They should be empowered to kind of do what they do best.
I think that is my take on it. I think that's you see. I mean, all the TV shows, to go back to TV shows, all the TV shows that get the greatest acclaim are the ones that cut a very particular furrow of their own. They're not a clone of something else. They're just doing their thing and saying, if you like this, this is what we're doing. Come and join us. And I think that's something that comics have obviously always done, but they're doing more now. And that's to me a very good thing.
Cool. Now, you had some Pendragon questions you wanted to ask Jason. I was going to delve into gaming questions, but I know
I asked one a bit already, but at the risk of being very nerdy, because I asked once while we were off camera.
And it turns out the Thing is potentially stronger than the Hulk.
It depends what he had for breakfast, but you know.
Yeah.
I was once I was trying to present my comics work as incredibly serious and academic, and I was at a meeting with the president of my university. And while I was there, someone in the audience asked me who would win in a fight between Superman and Silver Surfer. And I was just so mortified because I was like, here I am trying to be like the serious face of comics. And the answer, of course, is it all depends on whose book the fight is in.
Oh, yes. Now, that is the answer.
Yeah, right.
I think that's on page 477 of the Hero with a Thousand Faces, by the way, that answer.
Was it again?
I think that's on page 477. That's Campbell's The Hero with a Thousand Faces. It depends whose book it's in. Is there definitive answer?
But this wonderful 18-issue series that ran back in 1990. And I think, from what I can read, it looks like it was Image's sort of 6 issues at a time. Like,
yeah.
Didn't know if you were going to get renewed.
Absolutely. It was extremely... Marvel UK was really being as bold as it could be and knowing that we could get the rug pulled in all sorts of different ways at any moment. So we planned 6-issue arcs at a time. I think we were amazed to get 18, really.
Yeah.
It's interesting, actually, of all the things you could pick, Knights of Pendragon actually has a lot in common with Hercules.
Yeah.
As it's that idea of taking a modern superhero and explaining a mythological legacy that is the context for him being what he is or them being what they are in a modern world.
Yeah.
I think with Hercules it's been slightly more deliberate. With Pendragon there was an awful lot of I play the bass fiddle, your dad's got a barn, let's put the show on here and seeing what happened when we did it. But there's a lot in common. It's touching that same kind of eternal inspiration.
Yeah. There was a big environmental subplot in Knights of Pendragon. It was sort of the main plot, really. The book was printed on like a environmentally safe paper, and had these big. You caught a lot of attention to that, and one of the issues had a sort of Save the Dolphins charity group represented in it, and. I've got new dogs, so he's finding his toys. So my question was how did that environmental aspect come into the book? Is this still a concern for you? Are you still an environmental writer?
Yes. I'm trying to remember exactly how it came into the book I wouldn't say I'm extremely environmentally aware, but it is something that concerns me and has concerned me for many years. And certainly Steve White, who was the editor and sort of very much part of the creative process on the book, passionate about that sort of stuff. And I think when the environmental theme of looking after the sort of life force of the planet, the Green Knight and everything like that, was so strong in Pendragon. It was so much part of its DNA in terms of what the comic was about and what the heroes were fighting for, that it managed. We channeled a lot of our ideas and thoughts and arguments about it into that. It was very reflective of the creative personalities doing it. And I can't remember why the environmentally friendly paper thing happened in the first place. I don't know if Steve deliberately went to look to see if we could do that to sort of justify the argument we were having, or whether it was something concerned. I honestly can't remember, but it was one of those sort of perfect storm moments where when we discovered we could do that, we wanted to, and it meant that we could both support the fact that the comic was printed on environmentally friendly paper, and also support the kind of environmentally friendly stories that we were telling and make it look very deliberate and therefore get it past the people who pay for these things and the accounts department and that kind of stuff as being a very good idea, because there was a fundamental reason for it. You have to, as you say, it was 1990. You have to be aware that back then the although the environment was something that was talked about a lot, it's not become that kind of almost trope that it is today, where people sort of glaze over when you mention global warming and that kind of stuff. It was a growing thing. We wanted to get people talking about it because not enough people were talking about it. And the idea of using environmentally friendly paper then was really radical and shocking and surprising. And the fact that we drew attention to it was because people weren't doing it very much then. As you say, it's a long time ago, and the world, society has changed a great deal. Society's changed a great deal in the way it thinks about these things and talks about these things. And the sort of thing that would, you know, every fourth item on your Facebook newsfeed might talk about the environment these days. You know, it wasn't like that then. And it was something that we felt strongly that we wanted to put in the story.
Well, it was ahead of time.
Sorry, Jason. Yeah. So the cool thing being is it was actually really nice paper as well. It's actually better paper than the Marvel stuff in the US at the time.
It absolutely was. And I think that was the other, and then ultimately that was the kind of the clincher when we took it in front of the boss at Marvel UK and said, this is what we're going to do. I think there was a danger that he was going, yes, but look, it's like toilet paper, don't use that. And the fact that we could show it to him and go, oh gosh, doesn't it look great?
Yeah, it's like really high gloss stuff. Really. It was lovely, yeah.
Yeah. It was particularly good at supporting the very strong black line work, and Gary Erskine's art was all about that. It is still today all about that, particularly graphic stuff that he was doing, and the paper was just perfect for it. So, like I said, the whole thing, the story, the plot, the characters, the elements, the production, the paper, all those things were very much about three or four people sitting in a room getting overexcited about stuff and going, we can do this, somehow managed to combine those into something that was vaguely coherent, both as a marketing model and as a story, which I don't know. There was a lot of enthusiasm and a lot of goodwill, which was great.
Well, people still talk about it today. I mean, you probably would be surprised by this, but there are actually a group of academics who study Arthurian comics for a living, and we talk about you all the time, man.
No wonder my ears are burning.
So, Dan, are you still involved in the gaming writing you used to do?
Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, hang on. I was talking to you, sorry about that. Dan, are you still involved with any of the gaming writing you used to do?
Yes, I am. Two or three very busy. I think last time we talked, I was in the middle of, or coming to the end of things like Alien Isolation and the work on the second Shadow of Mordor, and I've done other bits and pieces for a number of different things, which has proved to be very, very good fun. But I actually am working now at the moment on a major game that I'm actually not allowed to talk to you about, unfortunately. But yes, I am. In fact, my wife and I are both working on it. We're sort of world building for something that if successful will be a major game launch, and we're doing it from scratch. It isn't the latest version of something. This is a brand new thing. We're sort of actually spending quite often at least a day every week traveling to another part of the country and working with the game design people and developing that. And I think that's going to be announced fairly soon. So I'll be happy to talk about it then. But it's great. A lot of the game work I've done, which I've enjoyed enormously, has involved me being brought in comparatively late in the process to develop characters, to develop storylines, or to write dialogue, which is enormously rewarding and great fun. Shadow of Mordor particularly. I mean, all the hard work was done there. It was just me coming in and inventing orc characters and personalities and doing stuff like that. With this, it really is going back to a very sort of primary sense of the game designer saying, this is what we want the playing experience to be like. What is the world? And that has led to some splendid things. We've been working on that for almost a year now, and I think they're about to get to the point where they announce it.
Do you ever think much yourself? Recreationally?
None whatsoever. There are I don't do that. There are a number of reasons for that. One is that I was never a gamer. I was always a reader and a comic reader and a sort of tabletop role-playing game, Dungeons and Dragons player, gamer. And I've gamed in terms of console games and PC games a little over the years, but never consistently and never regularly and never with enormous enthusiasm. And I think it's partly to do with my advanced years that I'm very old school. I'd rather play Dungeons and Dragons than play a computer game. But I think the other reason is that actually I think they are incredibly appealing. I think they're amazing. And if I did start to play them, I would not get anything done. I would just play them. I would just play and play and play and play. I think I would get very, very drawn into it. So it's kind of a deliberate act on my part to stay away from it. And that has led to, I think we may have mentioned this before, Mike, but that has led to what I think is an extremely strong asset in me, is that what I'm engaged with is characters and world building and story. And the fact that I have absolutely no preconceptions about games or the way games work, means that I can be the kind of idiot in the room with the game designers who asks the incredibly basic question about something. And so many times in the last few years that has paid off by it turning out to be a question that no one's ever asked, because they're all too immersed in gaming to have thought back to the very basic levels of that. And it means that we spend, in this current job, for instance, spend a lot of time with the game designers analyzing really how games work, what the language, not the literal language, but the sort of playing experience language of gaming is, and how to perhaps overcome some of the things that always happen in games that have now becoming tropes and that kind of stuff. So actually, my lack of regular gaming experience is deliberate and is sort of an asset, I think. There will come a point where I stop getting the work, because people go, you don't play games, go away. But that's, I don't know, it is very interesting, because you can, you can kind of get under the hood of it more, because you're not aware of the way things are accepted in a lot of things. It's the same in comics, it's the same in movies. There are a lot of things that happen in games that just happen in games because they've always happened. And because they always happened, people are quite happy for them to carry on always happening. And then wonder why things are becoming samey and repetitive and still hitting the same kind of storytelling snags that they've always hit, because there are perceived to be limitations to the way a game can tell a story. And my wife and I often sit there going, well, why? And the answer, because we always done it that way, is not sufficient. It's not an appropriate response. And we sort of get it. I'm not saying we're coming up with genius solutions for these things, but we're more aware of them rather than just being completely convinced by them. Does that make any sense? I don't know.
I meant to ask you about your tabletop gaming, because I know you used to do some work with Warhammer.
I still do, actually. Yeah, it's not as much as I used to, but I'm still writing novels for them. Tabletop gaming, again, a huge love of mine. Warhammer and Warhammer 40K, particularly Games Workshop stuff, love that. And indeed, I don't do as much of that as I would like to, really, for the very same reason that I would then never get any work done, because it's very addictive. But as a, going back to, late 70s, early 80s, I was, when D&D, Dungeons & Dragons first appeared in the UK in its original little box form, I became a keen player there, played that. Traveller was my favourite, Call of Cthulhu, RuneQuest, games like that, and that I loved that and played those for years. A lot of the friends that I, not my oldest friends, we were people who, as at school and at college, we played those games together. And I've, you know, down on my archive shelf, I've still got all my old rule books and character sheets and stuff like that. And I think role playing games in that sense, even quite happy to play it with, you know, dungeon layouts and figures on the table, but Traveller particularly played simply verbally, with a few sort of visual aids for players, and everything else was pen and paper and dice, was the most extraordinary gymnasium for your imagination. It really was. And I actually think, although I'm not now, as a professional writer, regurgitating storylines that I invented then, it's not like I'm using it as a template for everything I'm doing. I guess the sort of muscles that I developed as a referee sitting there, for instance, running a Traveller campaign and just inventing stuff on the fly, having a basic storyline, inventing stuff on the fly to suit what the players were doing and to make it more interesting and dramatic, was basically fine-tuned and set up the mechanisms that I use even today when I'm writing, particularly writing an ongoing comic and going, right, this is the storyline I'm following. What are the fun things that I can do spontaneously as I'm writing it that will make this issue interesting, will set up possible things for later issues and stuff like that. They are a skill set that, though I haven't played a role-playing game in a long time, they're a skill set that I use every day.
Cool. Actually, the guy who wrote RuneQuest, Steve Parent, he's a friend of ours. We do some small press RPG stuff, mainly superhero related. And Steve is currently working on a book for us set in the Golden Age.
Please say hello to him for me, because he's responsible for many, many lost hours in my youth.
Hey, certainly will. Hey, just out of curiosity, is there a secret Illuminati-like cabal of bearded British comic book writers?
Bearded, yes. It's a Samson thing. Without the beard, we have no strength. So to shave them off would be... I don't know.
And is Alan Moore the president, or you just kind of give him a drink and put him in a corner and talk business?
Yeah, he's not so much a president as a high priest. He has a special cutout chart of beard silhouettes, and when you're inducted to the cult, you have to present your beard to him, and in triplicate actually, and he compares it to the silhouettes, and provided you match one of those, then you're allowed to roll one trouser leg up and hold the sacred dagger, take the oath, and then you're admitted into the inner circle. I'm surprised you don't have one of those in the States.
So this is it. This is where I'm going wrong. I don't need to grow a beard. This is it.
I think now that you've told us all of this, your life is in danger.
Yes. See, the beard templars are already hammering at my door.
You have to shave your head and join Grant Morrison's club across the street.
Yeah. Well, actually, because I've got that as well, so I'm secretly a member of both, and I'm spying on both for each side. It's like a Dan Brown book. My life is like a Dan Brown book with beards.
Well, that's a movie I'd watch. Even if Tom Hanks wasn't playing you. So. Wait, I've got to get back to the bidding of my cruel corporate paymasters. Aid or Jason, do you guys have any more questions?
Just thank you so much, Dan, for taking time to talk to small presses like us. It makes the world for us.
Well, thank you for so many stimulating conversations. Always happy to chat. So yes, talk to me again, and I'll try not to become incoherent as I have done this week.
Anything else from you?
I've got about another 1,000 questions. So yeah, like I say, if we catch up with you when your game is announced, I will write them down and I will ask you then. So that's probably the best idea, rather than keeping Mike away from his paymasters.
Well, I look forward to that conversation. So great. Yeah,
thanks. There'll be lots of Doctor Who questions. By the way, so there you go.
Well, when will you be able to talk about that project then?
I don't know. I'm having another meeting early next week, and actually, I'll add it to my list of questions so I can find out when the announcement can come, so that we can actually talk.
Excellent. All right. Well, hey, as always, it's really a pleasure to have you on. Thanks for making the time to chat with us.
Thank you guys very much for the questions.
Take care.
Talk to you later, Dan.